Peter Allen next week in this slot. Coming up the top of the hour, which it is right now, in a minute, the BBC News, followed by a public affair. Aileen Muldrow in the house. Going to be talking about stories. Stories. Hopefully be some good ones. Have yourselves a great week. Peace.
With the BBC News. Prosecutors at Donald Trump's hush money trial have asked the judge to punish the former US president for violating a gagging order. The New York prosecutor said Mr. Trump had brazenly disregarded the order by criticizing witnesses. The former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, has since been giving evidence about how the magazine tried to help Donald Trump's presidential campaign before his election in 2016. Neda Taufik reports.
On the stand, a silver-haired bespectacled David Pecker outlined a long-standing, mutually beneficial relationship with the former president. In 2015, he said Donald Trump and his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, asked him how the tabloid The National Enquirer could help Mr. Trump's presidential campaign. Mr. Pecker said he'd agreed to publish unflattering stories about Mr. Trump's opponents and, crucially, to help catch and kill negative stories about him. It was never written out formally, but rather an agreement among friends, he explained. Donald Trump is sitting silently in court, but he has been fuming on social media.
Israel's military has rejected accusations its forces buried the bodies of Palestinians at a medical complex in Gaza. In a statement, the IDF described the Palestinian allegation as baseless and unfounded, Wira Davis reports.
For several weeks earlier in the war, Israeli forces besieged and then stormed the Nasser hospital complex in Khan Yunis. They withdrew earlier this month. Subsequently, almost 300 bodies were reportedly found buried in the grounds of the hospital, which is in southern Gaza. According to reports, some showed signs of having been summarily killed, and others had apparently been reburied. Volker Turk is the United Nations Human Rights Chief. His spokesperson, Ravina Shamdasani, said that Mr. Turk was horrified by the destruction at Nasser and reports of the graves.
US military planes landed in the Haitian capital Port-au-Prince, the first aircraft to touch down since the international airport closed on the 4th of March due to attacks by criminal gangs. Klitsia Sala reports.
It's not clear what or who the US aircraft was transporting, but a photo in local media shows the four-engine US plane on the runway. Reports say the authorities are expecting other planes to follow. It's a small sign that the situation in Haiti might be easing after heavily armed gangs exchanged gunfire with police and soldiers in March while trying to capture the airport. The Haitian government has started demolishing more than 200 houses near the airport that are thought to have been used as a hideout by the armed gangs that attacked the site.
A court in Moscow has refused a request by the American journalist Evan Gershkovich to be released from prison ahead of his trial on spying charges. The court has extended his detention until the end of June. World News from the BBC. A spokesman for the Spanish government says he's confident their security forces will catch a mafia boss who's on the run after being released on bail. Karim Bouyakhrishan, who's been on Interpol's most wanted list for 5 years, had been charged with money laundering and gang-related offences. He's also wanted in the Netherlands, where he was accused of making threats to kidnap and kill the heir to the Dutch throne, Princess Amalia. A Taiwanese father and son have each been jailed for 8 years for spying for China. The pair, who were recruited while working in China, were paid more than $50,000 to persuade military personnel to join a spy network. Two members of the Air Force who they enlisted were also jailed for 6 and 7 years. Tesla is expected to announce its earnings later on Tuesday, with analysts forecasting that revenues could be down by nearly 5% from a year ago. From New York, here's Erin Delmore.
It's been a tough year for Tesla. Shares are down more than 40% over the course of the year, and it reflects a couple hurdles that the company has had to weather. Competition from China, chiefly BYD, which briefly overtook Tesla as the top EV maker in the country, falling sales, cutting prices. There was a fire at a production center in Germany, the Cybertruck recall, and also supply chain issues stemming from the Red Sea conflict. The company has announced layoffs, and the expectation for Tesla is that sales will fall nearly 5% from a year ago to around $22.2 billion.
Anthropologists are examining a bathroom tile discovered by a dentist on a visit to his parents' house, which appears to have an ancient human jawbone embedded in it. The tile, made of tavatin, a type of mineralized patterned limestone, was quarried in Turkey and clearly shows a U-shaped structure with a number of teeth embedded into the bone. The dentist posted the image on the social media site Reddit. That's the latest world news from the BBC.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
Good afternoon, Madison. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is a public affair. Today, we are spending an hour with some amazing Black scholars who are working to expose and share a more complete history of Black Madison's experience in education. In that work, the Madison Voice Project aims to advance anti-racist curriculum, policies, and practices in our K-12 and higher learning institutions. I want to welcome all of you to the air today, and I'm going to give you all an opportunity to go around and introduce yourselves. And we will start with Ruby.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ruby Bafu. I'm a six-year PhD candidate in sociology. I study students' experiences in online learning spaces. I'm joining today from New York, but I joined Black Madison Voices in 2020 while I was still living in Madison.
Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being part of the program today. We will jump over to, you know, whoever wants to introduce themselves next.
Hi, everyone. I'm Unika. I am a recent Master of Public Health student grad. So I joined as a student. One student that doesn't study education specifically, but I found this to be a really rewarding experience to learn more about just the human experience and why it's important for health and just wellness. And I joined in 2021.
Welcome to the air. Dr. Rogers. Can we talk a little bit about who you are? Can you introduce yourselves to the WORT audience?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Hi, everybody. I'm Ariel Rogers. I use she, her pronouns. I am super excited to be here today with my sister scholars. I am an assistant professor at UW-Madison in the Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis Department. And it's been such a pleasure to work on this project. And we're excited to tell you more about some of the things that we're learning from the rich stories that we've been blessed to bear witness to through our work.
You don't have to, and it's in the mic.
Oh, hello, everyone. My name is Jaleesa Bryan. I use she, her pronouns. I am from San Diego, California, and I am a six-year PhD candidate in curriculum and instruction. I focus on informal learning spaces, so anything that's not a school, college, university, and try to talk about what's significant, especially for Black folks in those spaces. So happy to be here. I've been on this project since 2020, and excited to tell you more about what we're up to.
And Jaleesa, you're the only person who's here in person, live from the studio. So yes. I want a little shout out to the fact that we're hanging out in WORT together. And then we'll move over to, you know, one of our favorite professors, Maxine McKinney-Day Royston. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Ali. It's good to see your face and hear your voice. So I am Maxine McKinney-DeRoyson. I'm an associate professor at UW-Madison in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. And my work generally focuses on race and identity and teaching and learning. So what's going on in the classroom and how does it affect our Black and brown children? And I've been on this project since the beginning as well, since 2020. And it really is an honor to be a part of a Black woman-led research group where we particularly focus on the voices of Black folks around education.
This is such an exciting story that you all are telling, and a really complicated story. Madison has had a pretty controversial history of the way we have worked with students of color, but Black students specifically. And so, you know, I grew up here. I went to school in Madison. I started school in 1992, I started kindergarten. I was the last group of kindergartners who went to school half day. And I graduated in 2005. And at that time, if you were African-American in this community, you had a less than 50% chance of graduating from high school here. That number has improved, although not in the ways I think many of us would like it to. And there are certain things about the Madison school experience that persisted from my childhood to the experience my kids are having in our schools right now. I have three children, two of whom I have an elementary school student and a middle school student, and then I have, you know, a two-year-old who is, you know, just kind of vibing out, just living life. But it's amazing how much and how little has changed. Talk to me a little bit about why you all decided to do this work, and the stories that you all want to surface that you think our community is less aware of. And I'll start that question with, I'll start that question with you, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you so much. I think one of the things that is really important about the kind of the genesis of the project, and I didn't say this in my introduction, but I came to the project later. I had known Jaleesa and Maxine through various professional networks. Dope Black folks doing good work in education tend to know each other. And so I learned about the work that they were doing while I was finishing up my PhD at the University of Southern California. And once I learned about the project, something that again, I think is notable is that it started, the Black Madison Voices Project started because Black folks on campus, Black women particularly at UW-Madison were coming together as a writing group. So it started in community with each other, contending with the ways not only, you know, we wanted to design the research project, but how we wanted to be in community with each other and how we wanted to learn ourselves about how to be in service to the community more broadly. And so I think that that's an important framing for understanding kind of how the research project developed and kind of our orientation toward the project. And Maxine, I know that you have a lot of context in terms of the development of the project, and I'm wondering if I could tag it over to you to provide some context about what we're up to.
Absolutely. I'll build off of what you talked about with the writing group, because that's exactly how it started. Group of Black women writing together, all doing work around education, most of it focused around Black families, Black children, Black educators. And in writing together, we were like, what are we not seeing here in Madison, where we live, that we need to know about? And a big thing came up that we don't see the voices of Black educators. We don't see the voices of Black families. We don't see the voices of Black children. So there's a lot being said about what Black families, Black children, and Black educators need. And when we look at reports about racial disparities in Wisconsin and in Madison, it's these numbers that don't have the histories, the experiences, and quite frankly, the wisdom of these communities behind them. And we need to hear that. And we were kind of batting this idea around, and then I actually happened to be in a Lyft with a Black male driver. And he was asking me where I was going, and I was going to do a PD, a professional development, with some teachers. And he was like, I need to go do the professional development with those teachers. I was a student in MMSD. You know, I graduated a couple of years ago. They need to hear my story. I need to talk to them. And we were like, you're exactly right. How can we make that happen, right? How can we create a project where the voices of the folks who are most affected by our educational system can talk about what their needs and desires are, what their stories are, and how can we do it in a way that really centers folks whose voices are not typically heard, who don't already have a platform?
Oh, I so greatly appreciate that. And I think one of the things that happens when you're talking about the Black community in Madison is that Black people are flattened into, you know, just Black. I think about kind of the book Erasure, which was just turned into a film that was all about like how you tell the stories of Black people in a way that illuminates the humanity of Black people and whether or not we are responsible for perpetrating stereotypes in telling certain stories, how we present ourselves to the world and how the world wants to see Black people. One of the things that I think happens in education often is that we have a hard time talking about Black people who live at the intersection of gender and sexuality, Black people who live at the intersection of poverty, Black people who have disabilities, right? Who navigate the reality of disability. I want to ask you, Jaleesa, how will your work represent diversity among Black people, diversity among the Black experience, knowing that Madison has a relatively small population of folks who identify as Black, and yet those folks have really tremendously different experiences and identify as Black from a global perspective.
Yeah, I think what I really respect about the stories that come our way and that we're able to witness is sort of a difference between the reference of time that people bring up. People have a different way of encapsulating their educational experience. And when they're telling us their story, they start at different moments. They start at different entry points to Madison. Some people have generations of family who have been here. Some are coming in because of schooling or work. And they get sort of tagged into different roles that end up sort of multiplying because the community engages the way that it does. And so many of our participants so far have been folks that we've seen in community who we kind of run into and are like, you know, you have such an interesting story. We're kind of doing this type of work where we would love to hear how you've experienced schooling, but also other education. And because we've left kind of the door open for how people want to present learning and what they view as an educational space, so many incredible things have come up as important for development over time. And I think we're collectively starting to understand a really beautiful arc of educational trajectories over time and across spaces, just in this little city, which is really phenomenal. I actually feel very blessed to, you know, be a witness to so many different experiences. And I know we've had a lot of really engaging conversation around that as well.
That's so incredibly great to hear. And I think I want to ask a similar question to you, Unika, which is, you know, how do you make sure that you are capturing Black people in the full richness of all of our identities? How do you make sure that you're telling the story of Black immigrants and you're telling the story of Black queer folks and you're telling the story of Black folks who have navigated our school system with disabilities?
Yeah, absolutely. So first and foremost, our intake form and our interview protocol, we spent a lot of time developing those two materials to make sure that they were inclusive and were able to capture the stories of, individuals of African descent across the diaspora. And I myself am Jamaican. And so my experience in education and just like existing in the U.S. has been very different from my peers. And so I just really appreciate that we were really focused on making sure that we were able to capture stories, how different they are. You know, there are parallels, but there are bound to be, a lot of differences between us because of how we, have lived and grown. And I'm not from Madison, but, I've come to identify with folks here, even though I'm, very different from individuals that I interact with. I come to appreciate those differences. And so we really wanted to illuminate that in our project.
I deeply appreciate you making it personal, like giving us a little kind of taste of where you're coming from and who you are and how that influences the way that you want to show up and tell these stories. I think that's tremendously powerful. I'm a little curious for you all, as you've been telling this story, I brought up Erasure. Are there stories that you're hearing over and over and over again? I think one of the dynamics in Madison is because you have this huge achievement gap and because you have this massively disproportionate, Dane County jail that feeds into one of the most disproportionately Black prison systems in the country, that there is a tendency to see Black people in a really limited way. And there's also a tendency to talk about Black people instead of with Black people. How has the work you all have been doing, Dr. Rogers, illuminated the difference between kind of the way people in Madison like to talk about the Black community versus the way the Black community in Madison sees themselves?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that Black Madison Voices has done a really good job of is be intentional about communicating to our participants and to the folks who are honoring us with their stories, that you can tell whatever story you want to tell. And so one of the things that, was really important for us going into the project is recognizing the history and legacy of harm that the institution has had, particularly on Black folks in Madison, right? And so we know we weren't coming in with a clean slate. And so what we did with regards to the design of the interview process is really make sure that we held ourselves to really high standards and allowed for the folks who are engaging with us to also hold us to high standards. So we asked them, what are the stories that you wanted to tell in pre-interview? So basically, we have a pre-interview that we do that's just rapport building, where we're letting folks know kind of who we are, how we come to the work, letting them know about the process of what oral history interviews are, what we mean when we say oral history interviews, what the goals of the project are. And we ask for consent, really, in how we hope to use the stories, and then give them the power to say, these are the things I really want to talk about. These are the things I don't want to talk about. Don't ask me about that. And so we want to create the most comfortable and the most authentic space possible, so that when we get into that precious 60 to 90 minute interview, that they feel like they're prepared and they feel ready and in control to tell whatever story feels good to them. So I think that's something that has been a real ethical imperative for us that I'd like to think that we've done a good job holding ourselves accountable to.
I really love that there's kind of a consensual framework of like, what do you want to talk about? What is important to you to share with your community? And I think, as a young person, and I'm curious about how young people are informing this work in this project, like the people who are in our schools right now today, how is their voice showing up in this? Because I think for me, as a young person going to school here, it was hard not to believe what I was being told about myself. I really, at some point, felt like the easiest way to kind of survive my educational experience was to buy in to the idea that I wasn't a really capable or talented student, and that I would have to work really hard, and that I wasn't like inherently capable or intelligent in comparison to other students. How do you, I guess, acknowledge the portions of people's stories that are just really them accepting what they've been told about themselves and their community? How do you kind of tease that out? And I'm going to direct that question at Dr. McKenny Day-Royston.
Yeah, I think a big part of our protocol is trying to be humanizing, right? To make folks know that we're honoring whatever story they're sharing with and whoever they are. And so I think part of what that means is asking questions in the spirit that follows what someone wants to offer. So if someone wants us to interrogate, you know, is this an internalized message that you feel like you're receiving from school, then we're going to do that. If they want us to talk about race and identity, then we're going to do that. But at the same time, if they say that's not something they want to talk about, then it is our job as people who are engaging in a relational activity of interviewing with them to also not touch that, right? That's what that pre-interview work is around. That's what that rapport work is around before we even come into the interview space. And it's also the ethical work in the moment to know, given what the work you've done before with that person, to know if it's okay and appropriate. And even when we have conversations with folks that go into really difficult spaces, they always have the right to say, you know what, we talked about that, but that's not the piece I want to share, right? So we do what we call member checking, which is sharing back the audio and the video and the transcripts, sort of the text of what was shared back with folks we interview to see if this is what they want to share, because this is going to be a public archive, right? If you choose to have your name attached to it, you can. If you choose not to, you don't have to. But also, if there's parts of your story that, upon sharing them with us, that you decide, yeah, maybe I talked about that with you because I was vibing with you, but maybe that's not the story I want to share with everyone, there's a consent around that as well. And that is in their control to do as well. And so I think we're able to have those authentic conversations because we have consent, not as like a one-time thing, but as a continual process.
Thank you so much for speaking to that. And I want to follow up around that just a little. But before I do that, I want to remind folks you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Maldrow. This is a public affair. And today we're talking with five amazing scholars about the history of Black Madisonians and their experience, because these folks are working on the Black Madison Voices Project that aims to advance anti-racist curriculum, policy, and practices in our K-12 higher learning institutions. I just wanted to follow up and say, you know, how are our kids being represented in this? How are young people getting the space to tell their stories? Because we educate people who are as young as 3 and who are as old as in their early 20s. And so how do you make sure you're hearing from folks who are impacted by education at every level? And what does it mean to kind of adjust your interview to work with somebody in elementary school or middle school or high school?
I can begin and other folks can chime in as well. Well, one is because our project is focused on both K-12 and higher education, we have different questions that we ask different folks, right? And different ways we ask them. Part of our job as researchers is to not ask a question of a 30-year-old and ask that question the same exact way of a 5-year-old, right? That's not going to work. So we have to try to be developmentally appropriate in that. And we have spent a lot of time creating different types of questions, different framings for the questions, so that they would be understandable and accessible to folks of different ages and different walks of life. We also spend a good amount of time thinking about, would we offer interviews in an individual space or in a group space, right? We know a lot of our youth really like to kiki together in a group, and so we have a lot of focus groups that we do. And then I think we also brought our lens in as educators. I know I bring my lens in as a parent of, like, what would be an appropriate way to engage in conversations with young people, and how do we make clear that it's their story we want to hear, that, yes, we want to talk about education, but what the boundaries of that story encompass are theirs to define, not ours. I think another huge thing is that while we really want to talk with youth, they're also the hardest group to talk to, right? And to get consent from, to get engagement from, precisely because of what Dr. Ariel said earlier, which is that harm has been done on so many sides by trusted adults, by trusted systems, by, you know, non-trusted persons or systems. And so that's actually the population that we have least represented in our oral histories, because it takes a good amount of work to create the relationships where they feel like you're worthy of hearing their story.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you so much for speaking to that. I want to bring Ruby in on this question in terms of what it looks like to engage folks. I guess we've talked a little bit about the K-12 level. What does it look like at the college level, right? And I think about this in part because when I was on UW's campus, it was really like there was not that many of us. Like the group that is on this call is kind of amazing to me that there's like a handful of folks in the School of Ed doing this work at UW who look like me. But, you know, what does that mean when you are really, when you see so many Black people on UW's campuses talking about being tremendously isolating? What does it look like to kind of get the story from those folks?
Yeah, for sure. I think this brings me back to what some folks have mentioned about trying to do humanizing research, really just treating our participants as human beings, and really trying to engage in vulnerability and care around holding space for people's stories. I also think that this is where our personal experiences really come into play. Although I never went to college in Madison, obviously being a graduate student who lived in Madison, I can identify with some of the experiences that my participants share. And so I feel like allowing that empathy and that sympathy to come through in the interview really helps people share their stories and be more vulnerable. I'll never know again what it's like to be a college student, but I can identify with what it just means to be a student in Madison. So when people are talking about feeling isolated or looking for community on campus, that's something I can identify with. And I think that makes participants feel more comfortable to really just get into that. Because if you're talking to someone who doesn't know what that experience is like, it can be hard to kind of find the language for that. So I think that holding space for us to get personal too, you know, within the conversation really helps people open up about some of those more negative experiences that they've had, especially as college students.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I want to kind of lean into what you all hope to accomplish in doing this work. And I want to talk to you, Unika, about that a little bit, because I know you have to jump off a little bit earlier than the rest of the group.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. My hope for the project, and, you know, our hope actually is primarily empowering Black voices in Madison. That's the core of this project. And though we have like goals that include, adapting curriculum to more appropriately incorporate, Black knowledge and information that highlights Black contributions to science and education. We really have high hopes and aspirations in that way. But I think that what it comes down to is that individuals get to share their stories and those get to be displayed in public as they see fit. Like if they choose to be anonymous, then that, you know, we also offer that option as well. But I think sorry if you hear a baby crying in the background.
We're so pro babies over here at WORT. We're like, express yourself, you free little child.
Okay, thank you. But yes, I think that, that empowerment piece is really a primary factor here that we're working with, so.
I think that's incredible to hear. And I think there's such a need for that. In kind of the theme of what it looks like to talk to the folks in Madison about how our education system has, you know, impacted their lives or shaped their lives, I think the fact that we live in a city where the University of Madison is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I want to say it's about 2% Black in terms of undergraduate enrollment. Is that still accurate? Have we shifted a little? Okay, so we're about 2% Black. And then you have the Dane County Jail, which is about 12 blocks away from the UW campus. And the Dane County Jail is between 40 and 60% African American. The Dane County Juvenile Detention Center is usually between 80 and 95% African American. How do the stories of folks who are experiencing incarceration fit into the work that you all are doing? And I'll start with you, Dr. Rogers.
That's a great question. For the folks that I have interviewed, stories of incarceration haven't been kind of prominently discussed. I could definitely think about the ways in which we are creating space for folks to interrogate kind of the carceral logics. And I think that, you know, the parallel that you're bringing up and parallel and paradox, quite frankly, that we have the university so close to a prison system and the ways in which the carceral logics of prison systems are also embedded into university settings. I think that we definitely have a lot of stories about that. But we, from the interviews that I've done, folks haven't really talked a lot about that. I'm wondering if other folks might have stories to share there.
Yes, I have had two conversations with participants who have described carcerality in some form. And one story is the story of someone who was formerly involved, justice involved, as a young person and made a huge shift in their life. And they wanted to give their experience of education as one of credit to helping them make that adjustment. Another person talked about being sort of born, not necessarily into carcerality, but foster system, and which, you know, some folks can attribute to a carceral state and would theoretically. And wanted to name that the university during the time when they were going through undergrad gave them supports where they weren't able to find it anywhere else. And that the K-12 system, I don't want to misquote the program, but there is a program for a program for young mothers who were able to get the credits that they needed, become college ready. They had taken advantage of that opportunity and went to UW where there was housing for young mothers. Who were just starting out in undergrad, and there were three other women who had children for them to lean on. And so to me, that's sort of the importance of the parallel that you're bringing up, is that at certain times in Madison's history, these resources were available, and then they disappear. And it's sort of the luck of the draw when you get a chance to be the beneficiary of those things. And so I think one of the hopes for this project that I have is that we're able to amplify when those things happened and became beneficial and, you know, shaped people into the amazing leaders that we're able to see grow and become really big entrepreneurs and successful individuals and huge contributions to the community.
I think there's such an interesting dynamic that you just kind of teased out, which is that when somebody is struggling in our community, right? When somebody ends up incarcerated in our community, the story is usually about what they did wrong. It's not usually about having a series of systems that failed that person. However, when Black people are successful in this community, the story changes. And all of a sudden, it's a story about how we all came together to make sure that these folks were successful. How do you how do you shift that dynamic? How do you shift the dynamic of if you do well, it's because everybody showed up to help you, and if you struggle, that's on you. That's because there's something wrong with you.
Is this going back to me? I'm reading your eyes as if yes. Okay.
Yes, that's going back to you, Julissa. And yeah. I understand, like, that's a complicated question, right?
Yeah. And my eyes are searching because I'm more so trying to think about a moment in the storytelling and sharing that might have done that work already. And it's not coming up for me readily, but for me personally, as a researcher, we have made it a point, by Anika, we have made it a point to be intentional about the literature that we use to inform ourselves about who we're studying. We don't make the assumption that just because we're Black or just because we've been Black girls or just because we are Black women now or Black scholars, Black people who exist in Madison in a similar capacity to a lot of the people that we're interviewing, that we know their experience at all. And we also have made it a point to inform ourselves again of humanizing research, but also Black feminist praxis, which a lot of us engage as sort of a politic of the way that we navigate our lives. We care about people, we care about ourselves. We know that the literature on Black women in the academy who we are either reflecting or aiming to be, die at very young ages. And so in our ability to witness other people receive some sort of healing from being able to share their truth, we are also healed. And we don't take that for granted. And I think I'm drifting a little bit away from your original question, which was, how do you navigate that distance? We have to imagine it. We have to imagine something different than what the system tells us people are, because we already know that the system has imagined us in a particular way. And we work every day to try and combat how we're represented in space and in time. And we know that there's power in story. And we're happy to receive that from other folks, too.
Oh, thank you so much for speaking to that. And Dr. Rogers, I saw your hand come up as Julissa was answering that question.
Yes, just to build off of the great things that Julissa shared, I think something also that's reflective in our commitment to Black feminist praxis is also suspending judgment. Like, we don't come into conversation, into relationship, quite frankly, with the folks who are honoring us with their stories to say, okay, were you successful or were you struggling, right? Recognizing that it's never as clear-cut as that. Also recognizing, I can speak for myself, but I'm sure this is true for everyone on the call, we have all experienced success and we have all struggled, right? And so, like, thinking about how I think that your question is really powerful, because I think a lot of ways that researchers tend to go into relationship and into community with people has a particular set of questions or a set of assumptions or a set of judgments that we've been really intentional about trying to interrogate. Now, that's not to say that we've been perfect in doing that. And I think that part of to speak to what Julissa was saying about the ways that we are being healed and the ways that we are growing, not only as scholars, but as a community of people who are trying to do the work together in ethical and fruitful ways. We have been intentional about trying to dispel that myth or that narrative as we enter into conversation with folks.
Thank you so much for speaking to that. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. My name is Ali Muldrow, and today we're talking with folks behind the Black Madison Voices Project. If you have questions or if you want to recommend folks you think that they should talk to, give us a call at 608-256-2001. We will patch you through, tell us a little bit of your story, point us in the right direction of some stories that they should check out. I think that there's many people who are probably listening who are like, how do I get involved in this? How do I make sure that the people in my world know that this is going on? Because I think there's a lot of folks who feel like their story has not been told in this community. Can we talk a little bit about how do folks connect with y'all? How do you select who you're going to interview? How long do people have to continue to engage with you and tell you your stories? If folks out there are listening and they're like, oh, I know somebody who spent their life here and has a lot to say about our schools, how do we make sure those people get connected to the opportunity to speak with you all? And Ruby, I'm gonna ask that question to you.
For sure. Yes, I think the first thing would be visiting our website. Our website is blackmadisonvoices.com. And once you're there, you can scroll through, learn more about us. But there is like a little button that you can click that says partner with us. That will take you to our intake form. And that's what we use to ensure that, you know, the people who want to be part of the project are definitely the people who not necessarily just fit the criteria that we're looking for, but we want to make sure that when you're sharing your experiences, that this is the platform and the project that you want to do it with. So there is a little bit of eligibility required. Obviously, you know, we hope that you're Black if you're going to be part of this project. That's one of the things that obviously we ask on the intake form. So you can go to our website, fill that out. We will reach back out to you. We also have an Instagram. If you want to learn more about us, see what we're posting, I'm sure that we can get that out as well. But definitely want to look for us on our website, on social media, all that good stuff.
That's cool to know that folks can kind of just, you know, jump online and connect with this work. It's also nice to know that you all are explicitly like letting people know we want to talk to Black people, hear from Black people. Have folks who do not identify as Black said, yo, why can't I be part of this? Why can't I tell my story? Why can't I, you know, inform the Black experience? I know Black people. I've worked with Black people. I care about the conversation you all are trying to have, and I want to help to inform it and participate in it. What does that look like? Is there any pushback? Are people saying, hey, you're excluding, you know, some people by doing this? It's not fair. What does it look like to really guard the space for the Black community? And, you know, anybody can take the question.
Yeah, I don't think it has happened yet, which seems very un-Madisonian, but it hasn't happened yet. And I think in part it hasn't happened yet because we were very intentional on our website and our intake form and all of our communications that do you identify as a person of African descent across the African diaspora? And that this project is by and for Black folks. And so far folks have been respecting that boundary. I think there's many places in Madison where we can have conversations about transracial adoptions, about non-Black parents who are parenting Black children. And this is just not one of them. And I think that's fine and that's intentional, is that the point here with this project is to lift up the voices of Black educators, Black children, Black parents and families, Black community members connected to education about what they've experienced, what they desire, and what they need. And that is a population who hasn't had the opportunity in wide scale across the diversity that we've talked about in terms of age, gender, sexuality, migration history, to have that conversation. And in addition to hearing the stories, a real huge goal is to make those publicly available to other folks so they can see, you know, their family members and their loved ones and understand their stories, but also so that non-Black folks can hear these stories and have better insight. And so there's a role for the non-Black person in this, and that is as an observer and a learner, which is precisely what it should be.
I really appreciate that. I think, kind of the sit back and listen moment is a really powerful moment to have in a community like Madison. We talked a little bit about the percentage of the jail that is African-American on any given day in our juvenile detention center. We talked about UW's campuses being at about 2% African-American. The Madison Public School District is about 18% African-American students. Are there stories you've heard from the people who have gone to school here or go to school here that really stand out to you, that you're like, oh, it's hard to walk away from that story. I'm going to remember that for a really long time. I will always revisit that conversation. And Ruby, I'll start with you. Are there interviews that you're like, this person blew me away?
Yeah, I'm thinking about an interview that I did with a Black woman teacher in Madison who also has kids, you know, within the K-12 system. And I think that what really struck me about that interview was not only her talking about her own educational experiences growing up in Chicago and moving to Madison, but really just the struggles that she took on as a parent. And I also know her personally, so we've talked before about, you know, her experiences as a teacher and how that can be difficult as a Black woman in Madison. But what she really named to me was how hard it is trying to raise Black kids in Madison and really doing the heavy lifting of, you know, making sure that they feel affirmed in their Blackness, like nurturing them in that way to almost protect them and prepare them to go to school. I guess I thought that was very interesting because she also has her own experience and expertise navigating the K-12 system in Madison as a teacher, but still was just having these struggles doing that in the role of a parent and feeling like she's able to support her kids because of what they're experiencing in schools, because of the racism that they're experiencing, and kind of feeling like, how do I prepare them for this? Because at least with the stories that she shared with me, that was a different experience for her growing up in Chicago, where she was only really surrounded by Black people and didn't really have to experience that kind of racism within schools, right? So having to take that role on as a parent is something that just really sticks out to me when I think about how she tried to support her kids and is supporting her kids in Madison.
I think that's such a powerful thing to bring up, is like the experiences that Black educators have. Because again, that's a really small group of people. Our district, you know, here in Madison is about 18% African-American students. Educators is far less, make up a far smaller percentage. There are many students who go through their entire education, I was one of them, without ever having an African-American educator. And so to take into consideration, you know, what it's like to work in a district that has promoted these kinds of outcomes for Black students as a Black educator, I think it's something that a lot of people would have a hard time wrapping their heads around. A lot of people would have a hard time imagining. The school district, you know, is facilitated in partnership with the community through the Board of Education. The Board of Education is a majority Black body. I hope I'm wrong, but I actually think that the school board has more Black women. So the school board is made up of 7 people. And I believe that the school board has more Black women than the police department has working for them. And there's 3 of us. Okay. So there's 3 Black women. All of us went to school here, grew up in this community. There's one African-American man on the board who also grew up here and went to school here. Does the fact that the majority of the body that governs the district is folks who identify as Black, does that change kind of this moment in history in terms of education? And how do you all factor in kind of the political dynamics in terms of the way school is being invested in right now, who our leadership is at a local level, at a state level, at the national level? How do those things kind of find their way into the story that you all are trying to tell? And I'll ask that question to you, Jalise, first.
I'm trying not to get too big, but I think that it is important for us to all realize that whatever level we're working towards educational missions, we are still in the same system that causes harm, that iteratively causes harm, and is in many ways inescapable. Mm. And so we all have the task of trying to navigate in the ways we know how with the resources and tools that we decide to have. And that's assuming that we know how to use them in a way that a healed person or somebody who is committed to their own healing would do it. I think that I have experienced Madison's political landscape that sort of frames education and some of the like informal educational spaces that are coupled with formal spaces as being highly political, having a lot of conversation around it that has less to do with the learners in the space and more to do with the relational energies between individuals or maybe even groups. And that sometimes that can get, that can involve a lot of lateral violence. And that as a community, we are yet to figure out how to have healthy conversations with one another to ensure that we maintain what our objectives are, that we still love each other at the end of the day. We might differ in the way that we choose to go about what we're up to, but that at the core of everything is love and a desire for those younger than us to have more than us.
I am going to ask this last question to the entire group, and I want to thank you all so much for joining me today on WORT 89.9. I'm going to ask each of you to take about 20 seconds to talk a little bit about why this important, this project is important to you, and you know, what you hope people know about this project, walking away from the conversation we're having today on WORT. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Rogers, and then we're going to hop over to Ruby, and then we're going to hear from Maxine. And then if we've got a little time, we'll give you the last word, Julise.
I knew you were going to start with me. I think one of the things that really has been most impactful about this work is being in community with the folks on the project. I think that we've learned a lot of lessons, hard lessons, quite frankly, about how to do the work in the ways that we have imagined. And that has really grown me as a scholar and as an educator. So thank you to all of you all on the project.
Heck yeah, go team. Dr. McKenny Day Royston, why is this work important to you?
Yeah, I think this work is important because it's an opportunity to change the narrative, to highlight structural inequalities, where places where we get in our own way, and I mean we as a Black community, but also we as Madisonians get in our own way to progress. I think this is an opportunity to show that we've been saying the same thing over and over and over again, that there is anti-Black racism in Madison, that white liberalism continues to foster anti-Black racism, that change is needed, and to stop looking to all of the people in power for the solutions who've been doing their projects for a long time, but to actually listen to everyday Black Madisonians for the solutions and to hear their stories and see the ways they've already navigated in spite of what has been about.
Oh, thank you so much for speaking to that. I completely agree with what both of you have said about why this work is so important. Ruby, let's hear from you. Why is it important to you to work on this?
Yeah, I agree with what Maxine and Ariel both said. I'll add that I really just appreciate the opportunities to do interviews with folks. It feels really special. It feels like an honor for me just to hold space for people to feel vulnerable and to be able to take ownership or take the lead on sharing their stories. Yeah, I just think being able to witness that is something that's really special to me. And it feels different from how I typically do interviews within my own work. I've never conducted an oral history interview before, you know, this project. And so just having, yeah, just a space for people to share their stories. I know I keep saying that, but it's just special, so.
I really appreciate it.
No, I completely agree. As somebody who gets to interview people here on WORT once a week, there is something like really beautiful about getting to be available to hear what somebody has to say. And it's absolutely been an honor to get to talk to you all today. Jalees, you are the last person who is going to talk about why this is important to you. And I'm going to ask you to remind people how they can participate.
Yes, folks can participate by visiting blackmadisonvoices.com. And we also have an Instagram that is Madison Black Voices. Please visit it. We just uploaded two new posts. One has the fabulous Ali featured on it. And thank you for having us here today. And honestly, what I hope for this project is that we have ongoing relationships with the community. And I mean this from the bottom of my heart, that it has been so healing to interact with Black folks in Madison, because graduate school in and of itself is isolating. You all bring joy into our lives when we get to kiki and crack up together and, you know, empathize with one another. It's all love. And then when we see you out in the community doing your thing, you know, it all adds up to a really wonderful space. So thank you.
I cannot thank you all enough for joining me today on WORT 89.9 FM. Huge shout out to John and Jade for making this show happen. Thank you for listening to A Public Affair. I'm Ali Muldrow. Thank you all so much for joining me.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show,
Freud wrote about crowds. He was very interested in the behavior of crowds, that, you know, if you get a lot of people together, they stop behaving like a crowd and they behave like a mob. And it's as though the primitive unconscious is released. There is a numbing, a kind of anesthesia of higher intelligence. It's as though when you're in a crowd, you know, you take the lid off the id and the primitive is expressed. And there's no bigger crowd than social media. And if you look at, you know, what happens on social media, it's exactly like what Freud predicted.
A conversation about the life and times of Sigmund Freud. Our guest is Frank Tallis, clinical psychologist and writer, and author of the book Mortal Secrets, Freud, Vienna, and the Birth of the Modern Mind. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
Prosecutors at Donald Trump's hush money trial have asked the judge to punish the former U.S. president for violating a gagging order. The New York prosecutor said Mr. Trump had brazenly disregarded the order by criticizing witnesses. The former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, has since been giving evidence about how the magazine tried to help Donald Trump's presidential campaign before his election in 2016. Neda Taufik is in New York.
On the stand, a silver-haired bespectacled David Pecker outlined a long-standing, mutually beneficial relationship with the former president. In 2015, he said Donald Trump and his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, asked him how the tabloid The National Enquirer could help Mr. Trump's presidential campaign. Mr. Pecker said he'd agreed to publish unflattering stories about Mr. Trump's opponents and, crucially, to help catch and kill negative stories about him. It was never written out formally, but rather an agreement among friends, he explained. Donald Trump is sitting silently in court, but he has